Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Gear, who is the Distinguished Professor and Chair of Political Science at Vanderbilt University. His book, In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns, won the 2008 Goldsmith Book Prize from Harvard University. Professor Gear is currently working on a series of projects that look at the news media's coverage of attack advertising and how negativity may help voters make better choices. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Gear.
Well, thanks for having me.
And you're quoted in a recent article in Bloomberg, perhaps having second thoughts here, saying we now have an excess of negativity in these negative campaigns. So are you revising and extending your remarks, as they say in Congress?
Well, maybe. I don't think of it in those terms, but neither do the members of Congress when they're revising and extending their remarks, I suppose. But I think what's going on here is that I would still defend, you know, attack ads and the information they provide and the role that they provide in kind of democracy. But I do detect a change over the last 20 years that I'm bothered by, as you referred to, calling it excess negativity, that what's unfolded is the journalists and their efforts to cover negative ads and in some sense to vet them and to give the public a full understanding of these ads have given a huge amount of attention to these ads. They don't pay much attention to positive ads. And because of this effort to protect us from negative ads, the ironic twist is that now consultants want to air even more negative ads because those are the only ones that will get on the free media. And so the incentives to run ads have changed, and there's now a greater incentive to create negative ads than there was 25 years ago.
So, but what I find extraordinary, John Gear, in this campaign is that fact-checking has become a cottage industry. It's referred to all the time, whether anybody actually listens to the facts. You know, there's that old expression that the lie goes around the world before the truth ties its shoelaces. So
right.
What do you make of this effort now, not so much in the presidential campaigns to fact-check the debates themselves, but to fact-check the commercials?
Well, I mean, I think the objective, again, about fact-checking commercials is a noble one. I mean, they're trying to vet these ads, but there's a series of problems, I think, with them. Problem number one is that they're bringing attention to the very ads that they're worried about by discussing them again. Second is that the model that oftentimes these fact checks have is that they don't want these ads to be misleading. But the difficulty is that all ads are designed to be misleading and that they're propaganda. They're designed to put the best foot forward of the candidate and the worst foot forward of the opposition. And so to find out that they're misleading is, you know, seems to me to be, of course they are. That's the purpose. And the real twist here is that because the negative ads are the ones that are more likely to have facts, the ones that are more likely to have evidence in them, and the positive ads are vague, general claims, that these fact checks disproportionately pay attention to the negative ads, giving even more attention to them. And so I'm not at all convinced that they are, you know, working quite as well. The intention is a good one, but the end result is I'm quite, you know, a little worried about.
So let me try and tie in negative advertising to compare it with presidential debates, given that we just had the second presidential debate, which certainly in terms of Obama's performance was quite different from the first. But my understanding of Romney's tactics were that he took the calculation that nobody much was paying attention and that in the first presidential debate, he'd have a substantial audience. As it happened, it was over 60 million people.
Right.
And that he could introduce himself for the first time to most voters and therefore repudiate his previous positions. But that seemed to me to have the effect of essentially negating millions, even perhaps a billion. I don't know how much money the Obama people had spent on framing him negatively and had been quite successful in doing so. At the end of the day, it would look, at least based upon the evidence of the first debate, that a good debate performance can overcome, you know, millions and millions of dollars of negative advertising.
Well, there's a couple of things there. First, I think this campaign, when we look back on it, isn't going to be the amount of negative ads, which are going to be unprecedented. It isn't going to be the amount of money spent that's unprecedented. It's the fact that all this money was spent with very little payoff. That is, it didn't move many voters. That first debate, I think there is an argument to be made. I mean, we don't have enough data to be sure, but there's an argument to be made, as you just suggested, that Romney was able to undo a lot of the attack ads that the Obama people had aired during the course of the summer. But among the reasons why that was possible was that Barack Obama, in that first debate, didn't hold Romney accountable. He let Romney get away with various claims. And in some sense, Obama needed to keep up the negative tactic of saying, look, you have all these views, you're going to favor the rich, and hammer Romney on that. And he didn't, and he let Romney move to the center unchecked. And so that if you think of that debate could have been much more informative if Obama had pushed back and said, whoa, wait a second, Governor, that isn't right, and it had been more engaged. So that debate itself is a kind of a highlights why negativity, so to speak, can be useful, because Obama could have had a chance to inform the public much more, at least based on what he thinks the right views are, than by letting his defense down and letting Romney kind of having an open field.
Well, I was talking yesterday, John Geer. Again, John Geer is the distinguished professor and chair of political science at Vanderbilt University and the author of In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns. I had a political pro on last night who's done a lot of Democratic presidential and Senate campaigns. So he's sort of been in the back room coaching candidates. And we talked about this extraordinary odd democracy that we have here in the United States, given that most of the country doesn't even know there's an election going on, yet up to $6 billion are going to be spent almost all on the swing states. And as you get closer to the elections, the undecided, the swing voters, become the attention of all that money. And at the end of the day, this political pro pointed out the terrible irony that these swing voters, or who are politely referred to as low information voters, are totally disengaged and perhaps not the brightest amongst our population. And yet they're the ones who ultimately decide.
Well, there is certainly a concern about that. But a lot of those undecideds may not even vote. It may also be true that they're just waiting to the last minute. I am reluctant, as a general rule, to say that, you know, in some sense, your argument is that, you know, we're being governed by the worst, that is, the least informed. And, you know, it's hard to decide what exactly the amount of information a particular voter, you know, should have, or what, you know, low information versus high information. It's clear that the undecideds are different than the people who have decided. But the people who have decided, the partisans, they're not looking at both sides of the information. They're either pro-Romney or pro-Obama, and they're kind of dismissing the other side. So it's more of a mixed story. I mean, this country has, you know, people worry about it every election cycle, and the country continues, even though we're in a recession right now, you know, the country continues to do well, at least as far as its fundamental institutions. And so I'm kind of more of an optimist in general on these kinds of things. But then again, I'm defending negative ads, and so I'm already out there as an odd duck.
Well, I'm sure you would, John Geer, you would defend debates, and surely we need more of them, don't we?
Well, I have to say that these two debates have been pretty informative, and I think they're a good format. I mean, one of the ways to think about presidential campaigns, or really any campaigns, is that, you know, you think of it as a heavyweight fight. And it is to some degree, but for the most part, the candidates stay in their respective corners and then construct images that are caricatures of their opposition and hammer away at that. But a debate's different. You've got to go toe-to-toe. You've got to go into the center of the ring, and you risk the possibility of getting, you know, a knockout punch laid on your chin. But that's why it's so interesting. And there's various points in time where those, you know, they weren't happy with each other, and they were, you know, jockeying for position. And, you know, I think, you know, Romney made a couple of tactical mistakes in the debate, not that it was a disaster, but, you know, Obama probably won overall, but certainly by comparison to the first debate, there was a gap, but it wasn't anything like that first one where Romney clearly did have the equivalent of a knockout.
And my understanding is that, I think you put your finger on it here, John Geer, that these people don't like each other. And my understanding is that one of the reasons why Obama had such a lackluster debate was that he simply felt, you know, uncomfortable being in the same room as somebody that he really doesn't have much respect for. And that may have been fatal for him in that debate.
Yeah, it's possible that, you hear these speculations, and, you know, by the time a campaign is at this point in time, given how close it is, usually the combatants aren't buddies.
Right.
And so that's kind of natural. I don't think that McCain and Obama were friends, and Kerry and Bush were not friends, and you know, that just goes with the territory.
Well, you mentioned Kerry. Now, perhaps the mother of all negative ad campaigns was the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign,
right.
Largely orchestrated, I believe, by Karl Rove, who, of course, is still a very powerful player in the Republican Party and making, a singularly important impression on this campaign. With the various super PACs that he's organized. Now, that's even become a word in the vernacular, swift boating.
That's right.
So compare that one to what's followed, because that was in many ways both the nastiest, the sleaziest, and the most successful.
Well, the swift boat ad is a great example of my general concern about the process. The swift boat ads aired to approximately 1% of the American public. That was all the ad buy was, very small. Yet by September of 2004, near the end of the month, about 80% of Americans knew the term. The reason for that is that the news media covered the Swift Boat ads all the time, especially the cable networks. And so if you go and do a LexisNexis search, which is a search engine that you can do and look at news media coverage, the term Swift Boat got more attention in the 2004 campaign in major media outlets than the term Iraq War. And so the Swift Boat ads were a problem, and they certainly were a sleazy attack. But the reason they worked wasn't because of the ad campaign. It was because of the news media's attention to that ad campaign.
So do you think that Karl Rove... he's going to play a role. We know that, and we know that his super PACs and his 501c4s, which don't have to reveal the donors, are making huge ad buys. And my understanding is, if you look what happened in the most recent election in Wisconsin, towards the very end of that recall election, enormous amounts of money was spent. Not one home was not visited several times. Flyers was stacking up on people's front porches, and the airwaves were just saturated. So are we going to have this last-minute carpet bombing, obviously in the swing states, but do you expect it?
Well, I expect, yes, I do expect it, but I don't think it's going to make much of a difference at the presidential level. I've been somewhat surprised by how disorganized the super PACs are. I've been somewhat surprised by the quality of the ads, which I don't think are very inspired. And we have people who have very set preferences. I mean, we've talked earlier in our conversation about the small number of undecideds. And it's just going to be hard for these ads to do much moving because there's just not that many people to move. But where I am worried about the super PACs are dumping money like in a Scott Walker recall, but doing it at a lower level so you maybe change a Senate race, so you change a House race. I mean, imagine if all of a sudden some super PAC arises supporting Aiken in Missouri. I mean, that might be able to get, you know, in a close contest, give him a sudden boost that allows him to win that seat despite all his problems. And again, that's a bigger concern because as you go down the ladder of elections, people have less information and they're more susceptible to being, you know, moved by these ads, and that could make a difference. But it's, you know, it's a really brave new world out there since Citizens United, and we just don't fully have a handle on how all it's working. I suspect 2016, they'll be, you know, have learned some lessons, and the super PACs, whatever effects they have in 2012, I bet they're even stronger in 16.
Well, one of the more surreal questions that came up, well, the question wasn't surreal, but the atmosphere felt it, was that question about asking Mitt Romney about George W. Bush. I've never seen anything like it, as though our former president is totally toxic.
He is, and it's... And I think that the long run of history, I mean, it's not that he's necessarily going to go down as one of the top five presidents, but I do think there'll be a renaissance of sorts with George W. Bush. And it's interesting because the economy, even today, even 4 years after he left office, or almost 4 years, still a huge hunk of the electorate assigns a responsibility for our economy to him rather than to Obama. And that's pretty unusual. But it was interesting to see that there, you know, Romney certainly referenced Reagan in a positive way, but he tried to distance himself from George W. Bush. And then even Obama twisted it in a way that I thought was interesting, pointing out some of the things that Bush had done that was right that Romney opposed. So it was an interesting exchange.
Well, my understanding is that actually Bush and Obama have quite a friendly relationship.
You know, I do not know any of the presidents or former presidents, but it is my understanding from people who do know them that, you know, there is kind of a club, and these people have, you know, when you sit behind that big desk, you understand the pressures, and so they do talk and they do share information. Bill Clinton, early in his term, Richard Nixon didn't live very long after he was elected, but did live for about a year and a half or something like that. Clinton stayed in touch with Richard Nixon because Nixon knew so much about foreign policy and he respected him, and Nixon was very happy to provide, you know, whatever counsel he could. So I think it's an interesting dynamic that unfolds that people don't expect, but it really does work. And these, you know, if the president calls, and you're a former president, you still answer the phone.
Well, in Nixon's case, he was the first to identify Bill Clinton as an up-and-coming Democratic star.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And, you know, Nixon, despite whatever weaknesses he may have had, was a really highly skilled politician, and he understood the landscape, and so that he could provide advice to all kinds of people, and he could identify the people who might have the juice, so to speak, to go forward. And certainly Bill Clinton did then, and he still does now.
Yes, the big dog is probably one of the best campaign assets that Obama has.
Absolutely.
So just in closing then, John Geer, you mentioned the idea that these super PACs could pour money in and carpet bomb, particularly for Senate and I assume House candidates as well. In the last minutes, and maybe something you mentioned the case of maybe somebody like an Aiken in Missouri who's in trouble. If there was sufficient money pouring in, then it might be able to reverse the trend. But that sort of flies in the face of the traditional logic about campaigns, and that is the down ticket effect of who's at the top of the ticket, being the president. So are you suggesting that this down-ticket effect is not as great as it was?
I don't think, we call it coattails. I don't think either of these candidates are likely to have a lot of coattails, a little bit maybe. If there's a sudden surge towards, you know, Romney, and a lot of the undecideds might, when they go to vote, if they're voting for Romney, they might just throw, you know, a few more votes the Republicans' way. But there probably won't be big coattails. I mean, these individual races often have a dynamic that separates themselves from the presidential race. But there's some coattails, but again, it's not going to be sizable, I suspect.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Geer.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with John Geer, who's a distinguished professor and chair of political science at Vanderbilt University. His book, In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns, won the 2008 Goldsmith Book Prize from Harvard University. And Professor Geer is currently working on a series of projects that look at the news media's coverage of attack advertising and how negativity may help voters make better choices. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the issue not raised in last night's debate, global warming.